There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
But Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. It turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's legal issues, which are complicated and bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter. Wow, those are all especially applicable this week, actually. They also bring up questions about whether Michael Avenatti is a good lawyer and whether Michael Avenatti will call you up and yell at you if you say he's maybe not a good lawyer. It was clear we needed to devote some time each week to answering some of the biggest legal questions, so I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So I hear you got an interesting phone call this week from Michael Avenatti. What did he want to discuss with you?
I wouldn't really characterize it so much as a discussion. It wasn't really a meeting of the mind so much as Michael Avenatti yelling at me. I had been saying a thing or two about him on Twitter in response to various comments about his ongoing legal travails. And first he unblocked me to insult me and tell me that I was a nobody and I should shut up, which I did not do. And then out of the blue, he called me. And I pick up the phone and he said, "This is Michael Avenatti." And so I Googled the number that was showing up on caller ID, and sure enough, that was a number associated with Michael Avenatti. And he proceeded to berate me for the better part of, say, 5 to 8 minutes, saying basically that I was a nobody, a negative Nancy, a pansy, jealous, and a whole bunch of words that I'm not supposed to say on the show or else it'll upset my producers. He said I was a despicable lawyer, and that notwithstanding that I'm a complete nobody, that people call him all the time to talk about what a nobody that I am.
And as one does.
Yeah, exactly, and how sad it was that I'm obsessed with him. He inquired whether I had ever done anything worthwhile in my life, answering no for me before I could address that. He suggested he wanted to come on the show, so I invited him, but then he clarified that he only wanted to debate in a public space about real issues, not private things, which seems to encompass anything he's ever done wrong, and also that probably he was going to hit me because I was a bad person.
He also then went on Twitter and denied that he had called you just after he called you, right?
As one does, yes. Although, again, multiple people told me, yeah, that's the same number he called me from. It was happening in the middle of a Twitter discussion with him. He used the same terminology that he was using in writing to me. It was consistent with calls he'd made to other people. But he totally claimed that I had been spoofed by somebody.
Based on your direct personal interaction with Michael Avenatti, would you say that he is a good lawyer?
He is not a good phone lawyer. I would not say that he has a soothing phone presence. Exactly. The man has some courtroom talents. He's won some significant cases for clients, which is a good thing for a lawyer to do. He's gotten clients big money. He wound up facing down the President of the United States and Michael Cohen to get them back off enforcing a hush money agreement against Stormy Daniels. That is certainly an accomplishment. But he seems to be spinning out of control. Between this, his bizarre conduct in the bankruptcy case, for which he has to appear at an order to show cause hearing shortly, and his general media collapse, none of this is a success story for the American mental health industry.
Speaking of good lawyering, let's talk about Congressman Devin Nunes. Nunes is the Republican former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He's come in for a lot of criticism for how he handled his job running that committee. The broad allegation is that he has run interference for President Trump, seeking to stymie other investigations into Trump's alleged links to Russia. Now Nunes is suing some of his critics for what they've said about him on Twitter. He says he wants $250 million in damages. One target of his lawsuit is Liz Mayer, a Republican communications consultant who has been loudly critical of Nunes for years. He's also suing two anonymous accounts called Devin Nunes' mom and Devin Nunes' cow. The Nunes family is in the dairy farming business. Nunes is also suing Twitter itself for reasons that we will get to in a little bit. But first, I want to bring in Liz Mayer, who we have on the show with us today, to talk about the lawsuit against her. Hello, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh.
So, did you defame the congressman?
Well, I'm not going to get into the details of the litigation. Obviously, I'm a defendant in it, and being a recovering lawyer and also a communications advisor who works on litigation communications issues, this is not the kind of thing that we comment on. I will say that a formal response to Representative Nunes's lawsuit will be forthcoming. I'm sure that when that is out there, you will be paying attention to it, as will many other people. What I really think that this is about and what I would like to talk about is really the First Amendment and really freedom of speech, which I think is an absolutely important principle in our country. It is a foundational principle in our Constitution. And as somebody who has always been a libertarian Republican, it's something I feel really strongly about. You know, clearly Representative Nunes and I have very different views with regard to the applicable law. It also appears from where I sit that Representative Nunes and I have starkly different views on civil liberties writ large, and that is true with regard to the First Amendment in particular.
Ken, can we go over what defamation is exactly? Because defamation essentially creates an exception to the First Amendment. It's a kind of speech that you can be punished for civilly. And so for a statement to be defamatory, it has to be a false statement of fact. It has to be damaging to the reputation of its subject. And because Nunes is a public figure, the statement would have to be made with actual malice, which is to say that the speaker would have to know that the statement is a false statement of fact, or at least be speaking with reckless disregard for the truth. Do I have all the elements right there?
Yes, that is right. And I think probably the key one here is the idea it has to be a provable statement of fact. In this context, it has to be something that a reasonable person familiar with the medium and the context and the people involved would interpret as a assertion of provable fact and not as an insult or opinion or rhetorical hyperbole. I'm a little shaky here, Josh, because I'm still reeling from somebody being really smart about not talking about the case they're in the middle of. I'm not used to people doing that. It scares me a little bit.
Let's take one of the statements from the lawsuit. It says that Devin Nunes's mom, quote, falsely stated that Nunes would probably join the Proud Boys if it weren't for that unfortunate no masturbating rule, unquote. So the Proud Boys is this kind of weird quasi-fascist group. Ken, could it be defamatory to say that Devin Nunes would probably join that group if not for this prohibition on masturbation?
Almost certainly not. It's clearly rhetorical hyperbole. It's clearly an insult and a joke. Anyone familiar with the medium and with the people involved would understand it that way, would understand that this wasn't actually Devin Nunes' mom, and would see that it's, you know, political theater. But fairly commonly now, there are lawsuits that shove together 99 clearly satirical or insulting posts and one that's maybe on the margin of possibly a statement of fact. And that's the way that people like this chill people from participating in political debate.
Liz, can you talk a little bit about your role in the debate here? I mean, obviously, you talk about the importance of the First Amendment, and we don't want a situation where you can't have a freewheeling political conversation that maybe even includes insults by claiming that those insults are defamatory statements. What is the source of your interest in Devin Nunes, and sort of, you know, what has led you to be, you know, so prominently in this conversation about him over the last few years?
Oh, well, I mean, there are a number of things. As I said, I think he and I have a very different read when it comes to civil liberties, and there are a number of aspects of his record that you can look at on that. The First Amendment is just the one that happens to be in the frame at the moment. You know, I think that that's my personal take on it. I'm sure that there are many other critics of his who would have different views on that. But, you know, I also think that it is important that Americans do scrutinize the records and activities and behaviors and campaign committee and leadership PAC committee expenditures of politicians and public officials. And that is something that I do quite a bit of. And with regard to Devin Nunes, I will absolutely say that I have. In my view, since Representative Nunes is a public official, it's entirely proper and correct that his political committee expenditures, voting record, and conduct be subject to public scrutiny and debate.
Can I ask, and I realize how silly this question is going to sound, are you behind the Devin Nunes' mom and Devin Nunes' cow accounts?
I'm going to pass on commenting on that again. I feel like that gets into the merits or demerits of the lawsuit, and we're going to have a response to that, as I say, a formal response to that at some point forthcoming. All I will say is that as somebody who uses Twitter, I am intrigued by the bump in follower numbers that the Cal account seems to have seen.
Yes, the Streisand effect.
Yeah. So, Ken, can we talk a little bit about Nunes's legal strategy here? I mean, there's been a trend of conservative figures using libel suits as a weapon to fight hostile commentators and news outlets. Often those litigants have been represented by Charles Harder, who's a prominent defamation lawyer. He's the one who sued Gawker into bankruptcy. Devin Nunes is not represented by Charles Harder. He's represented by some guy named Stephen Biss, who has an Earthlink email address. Do you see a sign here that this lawsuit is maybe less well-conceived than some of the other defamation suits that we have seen in recent months and years?
This lawsuit is unusually buffoonish. The theories are scattered and try to pretend that applicable federal laws don't exist. It mixes together things that are absolutely clearly insult and hyperbole protected by the First Amendment, and it's seriously meandering. It seems to be almost sort of like some sort of ritual self-humiliation by Nunes, kind of a jurisprudential streaking. But on the other hand, it's very serious because it forces people like Liz to lawyer up and face the very stressful and expensive prospect of litigation to get rid of it. But yes, this is, even in an era of stupid, stupid lawsuits, this one stands out.
Liz, how are you, as you have discovered that you're being sued? I mean, how does that feel for you? What are you doing to prepare to respond to this lawsuit? Even if, as Ken suggests, it's not a very meritorious one, it could be quite expensive to defend.
I think anybody who operates in the profession that I do is well advised to always have a lawyer that you can call if something unexpected happens. And we do. So for anybody who's listening to this and is a public affairs consultant or considering becoming one, please make sure that you are structured accordingly and that you have those relationships in place, because you just never know what's going to happen on a day-to-day basis.
Ken, I want to ask you about the aspect of this lawsuit where Nunes sues Twitter. Now, there's a section of the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, that says that platforms are not supposed to be held accountable for the content that users post on those platforms. If I defame someone on Facebook, that person could sue me, but they shouldn't be able to sue Facebook. Does Nunes have a theory here about why this doesn't apply and why he gets to sue Twitter, because he doesn't like what Liz and some other people have said about him on Twitter?
Well, I guess it's a air quotes theory, close air quotes, that he has. It's the same one that a lot of far-right people suing Twitter have. The theory is this. So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act says that a platform like Twitter isn't treated as the speaker of something like the Devin Nunes' cow account, even if it edits some of the time. What people who are critical of social media have been pushing is this idea that platforms like Twitter have gotten so involved in micromanage editing content that they are no longer just a platform, but they are the speaker itself. They are outside of Section 230's protections. No court's agreed with that yet. It seems to fly directly in the face of the text of 230, which says it doesn't make you the speaker if you edit the content. And it really seems like a long shot. But this is the sort of thing that all sorts of nuts who sue Twitter, usually from the far right, have been trotting out. It's a familiar argument.
Well, I think we can leave that there. Liz Mayer, I want to thank you very much for calling in and joining us today.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak out about this.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, it's Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Ken and I spoke with Preet last week about some of the topics in his new book. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. It's not just Michael Avenatti. Sometimes we talk with good lawyers on this show. And in fact, last week, Ken and I spoke at some length with Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, who has a new book out called Doing Justice. Here's a sample of that interview. So what made you decide to write the book? I mean, obviously, President Trump gave you a little more free time than you were expecting. Why a book?
Yeah, so, you know, I expected to do the job of U.S. attorney for a bit longer than I did it. And I got to tell you that I had this idea to write about justice while I was still the U.S. attorney in a way that might help people in the office think about how to do the right thing, what truth means, how to accomplish justice in the office. And then in seeing what's going on in the world and seeing how truth has been turned upside down and people spout forward things like alternative facts, and people who are close to the president say things like, truth isn't truth, and the rule of law keeps getting undermined, and there's a lot of confusion and, I think, concern about how we go about getting to the truth and making sure that justice is accomplished, it occurred to me that maybe I have some experience in talking about how you go back to first principles and how you think about those things and how you think about what the truth means and how you think about the dignity of proceedings, and you think about how we might accomplish those things, not just in a courtroom when there's a legal controversy, but also in people's homes and in people's businesses and in people's offices. And so through the telling of lots of interesting stories, including ones about mafia cases and one where we had a cop who we accused of being an aspiring cannibal and other sorts of interesting things like that, there's some, I think, lessons to be learned about how we should think about justice in the modern day in the Trump era.
Yeah, and you're also well-timed here in that people are probably paying more attention than ever to the federal criminal justice system.
Right. So, I mean, now we live in this era where so many people fancy themselves experts on federal criminal law and procedure, certainly people on Twitter. So I guess my question is, in this book, you do a good job of sort of explaining what it's really like based on your experience. Do you think the whole special counsel experience has given people an accurate or inaccurate picture of what federal criminal law is generally like?
Well, I think it's given people a little bit of a confusing picture because a lot of what happens on the part of the special counsel is secret, and he doesn't go out and explain what he does, and instead you have former prosecutors like you and me and others flooding the airwaves talking about what's going on. But I do think that an important part of the book and another aspect of the book that I think is interesting to people or should be interesting to people, two things. One, it talks about all the things that everyone in America now at the water cooler is discussing. Case in point. Everyone wants to talk about how you flip a witness. And the word flip has been used more often on television cable news than in any time I can remember in history. And so is Michael Cohen going to flip? What causes someone to flip? What are the benefits of cooperating? How do you determine whether or not someone is being accurate? How do you corroborate them? The longest chapter in the book is actually called Snitches. And it's about all the ways in which prosecutors try to, you know, cause people to flip, what the morality of that is, what the process is. And I think that'll be interesting to people. And then second, the book obviously is a lot about the Southern District of New York, the SDNY, as people know it, that I led for 7.5 years. And so there's all this interest, not just in the special counsel's office and how it operates, but if you want to understand the DNA of SDNY, which now has, you know, the right and title to the Michael Cohen investigation and offshoots thereof, the book talks a lot about what the philosophy of that place is, what the culture of that place is, the kinds of people who populate it and how they make their decisions and how they decide to bring cases, and then sometimes how they decide to walk away from cases.
So as people are learning about how you flip a witness, Cohen is a really odd example in that he's not officially a cooperator, right? He didn't do a full proffer. So this is a highly unusual thing, right, where you have this kind of informal cooperation arrangement?
I don't think it's not highly unusual, but usually it's binary, right? Someone goes to trial or pleads guilty on the one hand, or on the other hand, becomes a signed-up cooperator. Now, Michael Cohen has said through his counsel that he wants to take responsibility for what he did. My view is, based on what I've seen publicly reported, I don't have inside knowledge, is that the Southern District of New York didn't think they could use him as a witness. He provided some information. The special counsel office probably thought the same. And though there's no formal cooperation agreement, Michael Cohen keeps saying that he still is hoping for something called a Rule 35 motion. And that is basically the same thing as regular cooperation, except it happens after your sentence. And so it appears that they're still trying to work out some way by which he can become what is known as a traditional cooperator just after the fact.
That was just a sample of Ken's and my interview with Preet Bharara. If you want to hear the entire interview, it's available on the web as a special episode of All the President's Lawyers. To download that, go to kcrw.com/ATPL. Ken, if I could turn back briefly to your phone call with Michael Avenatti, one of the claims he made while yelling at you is that he's the one who brought down Michael Cohen, that it was he who set all of this in motion, all this stuff we talk about here on this show, by suing Cohen over the hush agreement that Cohen was seeking to enforce against Stormy Daniels, that that was the move that knocked over all the dominoes and brought this guy down. Well, we learned something this week that undermines that claim from Michael Avenatti, because on Tuesday, the Justice Department released the search warrants it pursued against Michael Cohen, and they show that the department was looking into Cohen earlier than we all realized, that they got a warrant to search his Gmail account all the way back in July 2017, which is 9 months before the dramatic raid on his office and 8 months before Avenatti filed that lawsuit before long-suffering federal judge James Otero. So, Ken, what else do you see as the significance from what we learned from these warrant documents?
Well, perhaps the biggest item we see in them is the continuing redaction, blacking out, of all of the information about the campaign finance violation investigation. So the search warrants described a few investigations. One was an investigation into Cohen's false statements to banks in connection with loan applications and other transactions. And that is now familiar. That was part of his guilty plea, and it's been gone over multiple times. And the warrant application goes in great detail through how he withheld information about his taxi medallions and made false statements to banks and generally gamed the system in an effort to rescue his financial condition. But what the warrant applications also have is at least 20 pages of information about the campaign finance investigation regarding the Stormy Daniels payment and Michael Cohen's initial payment of that money himself from a home equity line to Stormy Daniels. We don't know what it says in there about it because 20 pages of the warrant are blacked out. Now, this is a very thorough warrant. It's a fairly classic federal white-collar warrant. Remember, to get a search warrant, you need to show the judge that there's probable cause to believe that at a particular location, there are specific items that are evidence of a specific crime. And so this goes in great detail through what they think the crime is, why they think these locations are important, and why they think particular documents and electronic items are there. But the whole part, the analysis of the campaign finance violation, is blacked out. That tells me that they still think there's a live case there. They are not done pursuing people for campaign finance violations.
So some people have been wondering, one of the theories about, there's this argument over whether it's even constitutional to indict a sitting president. You also have Justice Department guidance that directs you not to do that, even if the department might constitutionally be able to do so. And some people have floated this idea that there could be an indictment under seal of the president related to this campaign finance case, where the president is described as individual one and is described as party to a conspiracy to violate the campaign finance laws, even though he has not, as far as we know, publicly been indicted. Could that be a reason this is blocked out, that either that they have indicted him under seal or that they are preserving the option to indict him once he leaves office?
That could be. I mean, we really don't know how the Southern District or the special counsel would go about preserving charges against the president. There's really no precedent for it. We don't have any past cases to say this is how you do it. But I think it's more likely that the redactions are because they are still pursuing the investigation. There could be other people involved in the campaign finance violations, not necessarily the president himself, but people on his team, family members, anyone else who was involved in any conspiracy to make these contributions and accept these contributions in connection with the Stormy Daniels hush money payment.
Ken, let's talk about Jacob Wall. You said a couple of months ago that you were confident that Jacob Wall, who, in case people are somehow unfamiliar with who Jacob Wall is, he's like 20 or maybe he's 21 years old now. He's an extremely eager Trump supporter on Twitter who's very often the first person in with a response to the president's tweets about how awesome he is. He lies a lot. He likes to claim that he's just coming out of a hipster coffee shop and all the hipsters he's seen are talking about how much they love President Donald Trump. So Jacob was in Minneapolis recently in an effort to demonstrate that Minneapolis is a city overrun by Muslim jihadists and full of no-go zones. And he complained to Minneapolis police that he had received a death threat through Twitter. In a web video about his adventures in Minneapolis, he shows a screenshot of a direct message that purports to be from a man named Drake Holmes, a gay man who works as a diversity coordinator. And he makes a very vulgar and explicit threat to kill him and also to defile his body should he run into Jacob Wall at any time in any part of Minneapolis. But apparently there's no such person as Drake Holmes, who works as a diversity coordinator. The photo that was associated with this Twitter account is actually of a man named Aaron Delgado, who is a mortgage specialist in Minneapolis. He says that he does not follow the news or even have cable. He definitely is not a diversity coordinator named Drake Holmes, and he did not threaten Jacob Wall. And Delgado has threatened that he will file a lawsuit against Jacob Wall for defaming him. Ken, what do you make of this latest misadventure from Jacob Wall?
You know, I said that Jacob Wall would eventually graduate to big boy federal crimes all on his own. He's not there yet, but, you know, he's trying. There are some reports that this account that threatened him is one that he himself created during a spate of Twitter account creations. And if that's true, and if he knew when he reported this to the police that he was reporting a threat he made to himself on his own fake account, well, then that's definitely filing a false police report, making a false statement to the police, probably several state crimes. It wouldn't be a federal crime unless he knew it was going to be passed on to the feds, but it is a problem, and it's certainly a problem for the poor guy whose picture he used. Now, just because right now we're kind of in American political sweeps and there have to be crossover episodes, who else would come riding to the rescue of this man whose picture was misappropriated but our friend Michael Avenatti, who now says that he is representing the man whose picture was misappropriated and will be helping him file criminal charges and perhaps some sort of civil suit. Remember that there's past bad blood between Michael Avenatti and Jacob Wall, who, to my mind, are people who deeply deserve each other based on some of Wall's past bizarre accusations against Avenatti. So this is so ridiculously 2019, I can't even stand it.
And so what sort of claims would Delgado have here? I mean, if they take your face and put it next to some other person's fake name and a fake threat, have you been defamed?
Yes. I think that if they attribute to you a statement you didn't make that is harmful to your reputation, you could be defamed. The question is going to be whether if they just attribute it to your picture but not your name, whether that's defamation, since people generally understand that Twitter accounts often have fake pictures. But it's a colorable claim. You would not get rid of it easily.
And so he's retained Michael Avenatti, or Michael Avenatti says he's been retained, and then you also have a local lawyer in Minneapolis. What would a California-based lawyer like Michael Avenatti do in litigation like this?
Caper in front of cameras mostly, but I'm sure he would show up and with great ceremony do whatever minor ministerial task it takes to file a complaint with the police, whatever else he can convince the police to do.
There is so much more to talk about, but I think that is a good place to leave it for this especially stupid week. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW, and you can also find us on Facebook. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.